My guest today is Dr. Reza Shadmir. Dr. Shadmir is responsible for developing a theory and paradigm to study the question of how the brain learns to build internal models for the purpose of controlling our movements. His education journey includes a bachelor's in electrical engineering from Gonzaga University, a master's in biomedical engineering, and a PhD in computer science robotics from the University of Southern California, and finally, a McDonald Pugh postdoctoral fellow at MIT. Currently, he is the director of the Biomedical Engineering PhD program and leader of the Shadmir Lab at Johns Hopkins University. His contributions to science include consolidation of motor memory, state space theory of motor adaptation, multiple timescales of motor memory, a theory of movement, vigor, and its link to trait-like features of individuality, neural encoding of action by the Purkinje cells of the cerebellum. In addition, Dr. Shadmir is the author of 3 books and has numerous publications in top scientific journals. Today's episode is all about motor movements and the physics of motor movement, including motor learning and memory, prediction and error correction, Purkinje cells, and more. If you remember previous comments of the podcast about how the brain is a prediction machine and it uses internal calculators, and how the central nervous system is designed to move the living organism, by the end of this episode, you will know more about why I say that. Today, we will explore a very underrated yet powerful area of the brain called the cerebellum. But first, a message about Daylight Computer Company and Chroma Light Devices. I would like to take a moment and mention a pressing issue we are seeing in our modern world. And that is tech use and tech light. The data are impressive and concerning on isolated wavelengths of light, especially shorter wavelengths, which is blue light. For those that don't know, we have chromophores, which are special proteins that absorb specific wavelengths of light. For blue light, the light that is LED light and tech light, that protein is called melanopsin. Melanopsin is responsible for our circadian biology, physiology and cell functioning, hormone regulation, and even a connection to an area huge for mood. A consideration we should include is this protein was not even discovered until 1998. It seems important for us to understand how our biology uses the different wavelengths of light for various aspects of our biology. This blue light chromophore is our master controller, our master clock. Remember, circadian rhythm is a 2-part process, 2 independent parts, light and dark. For a quick reference, see the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. But for now, I have something exciting. I want to introduce a product unlike any other product available. A highlight is the product from Daylight Computer Company created their product based on these factors. The Daylight Computer is completely blue light free. It has no flicker. Short wavelength flicker is extremely harmful for our eyes and downstream biology. Light flicker is constantly turning our central nervous system on and off. Essentially, it is like going to a light switch and repeatedly turning it on and off. The problem is, blue light and LED light does this, and it is so rapid, you cannot even perceive this in real time. The daylight computer is the lowest stimulation and foremost for sensory-sensitive users. It is no question that the alternative product, especially when used at night, do not address or consider this in their product. It is so toxic to human biology. Big tech corporations have patents on how their short wavelength implicate the human nervous system. And a bonus, despite daylight computer not having backlight, it is very functional for outdoor use. And of course, increased sunlight is always preferred. I am happy to offer a discount for the daylight computer. You can use the code AUTISM for a $25 off coupon. Again, use the code AUTISM and the discount code for $25 off. See the link in the show notes to Daylight Computer Company, or just give it a quick search in your internet browser. Use the code AUTISM for $25 off. I would like to mention Chroma, lights designed for humans. Chroma, a Seattle-based innovator founded by ex-NASA and Air Force engineer Michael Shapiro, is on a mission to enhance physical and mental health with purpose-built devices. Unlocking peak human health, cognitive function, and performance. Shapiro launched Chroma to restore the natural light lost to screens in indoor living, and delivers faster recovery, sharper minds, and better sleep. Their products hit hard. The Iron Forge speeds muscle repair with red and near-infrared light, while the Skylight mimics sunlight to boost sleep and energy. A standout, the Forge Lamp, is a portable gem that fires 660 nanometer and 850 nanometer light to energize mitochondria and heal tissues on the go. Remember the four red light chromophores on cytochrome C oxidase, frequently talked about in the podcast. This is why. Their products are built with military grade durability that have lasting impact. Chroma's tech fuses precision and power. Gallium titride power supplies, smaller, cooler, and stronger than silicone, provide flicker-free light that's easy on the eyes. High-powered LEDs target key wavelengths for skin, tissue, and cellular health with smart heat management for the lasting impact. Every design decision Chroma makes serves a purpose: to create devices that are precise, durable, and effective for improving human life. Remember, humans use different wavelengths of light for different functions of life. Remember when I ask, what do you think light is? Chroma designs with our biology in mind, from sleep aids and wound healing to mitochondrial energy, full body lights and blue light blocking glasses. They are US made, and Chroma ships globally and accepts FSA and HSA payments. Use AUTISM at checkout for a 10% off discount. That's AUTISM at checkout for a 10% off discount.
Can you share a little bit about your path into research and specifically the cerebellum?
Sure. I was a kid raised in Tehran in Iran, and when I was a teenager, I was lucky that the U.S. Embassy on Roosevelt Street, some 50 years ago, 1977, they decided that I was good enough that I could deserve a visa to come to the U.S., and I did. And I went to Spokane, Washington, which is a small town on the eastern part of the state, and raised by foster parents who loved me just like their own son. And I was watching TV one day, and I was watching public television. And they had a show about the brain, and it really excited me because I thought that this is the most interesting thing in the world to study, but not just studying using biology and techniques of biologists, but techniques of engineers. And you know, the idea being that in engineering, one has tools to study complicated systems, and maybe if we applied some of those tools to how the brain worked, it would, you know, uncover some mysteries that would be otherwise difficult to understand. And so I remember going to my academic advisor and telling him I wanted to study the brain. And he said, well, you can't do that here. You have to go to grad school. So I said, that's what I want to do. And so I did. And then in grad school, I became interested in thinking about control of movements because I was taking courses in robotics. And I realized that robotics is sort of like asking the engineer to be the god. You are the god of this machine. Make it move the way you want to. And I thought some of the principles that are in engineering that describe how machines should be controlled presumably relate to how the brain controls our movements. And so if we could apply some of the tools from robotics to control of behavior, maybe it will help us understand how the brain controls our movements, and that was the basis of you know, my lifelong goal in trying to understand how the brain controls our movements, in particular our movements and eye movements.
Yeah, the engineering is a fascinating pathway into this, I think, because I was reminded of like a computer numeric controller, which, you know, like a CNC programming controls the machine, the speed, where it goes, you know, its endpoint, where it returns home, and everything. It's kind of like that pathway with your engineering gave you this access that I think a lot of other people were overlooking or didn't even think about yet.
Yeah, you know, if you think about, like you said, a CNC machine, you are dictating to the machine, its actuators, to move things the way you wanted them to. And that gives you a window to asking questions like, why do we move the way we do? You know, what's good about the way we move that makes us all want to move the same way? Meaning, you know, like my hand, when I ask to reach to an object, I more or less do the same as the way you do it. And so this was actually one of the first questions that my field became interested in, is sort of regularity in how people move. And What's the basis of this regularity? You know, what's good about moving this way? And writing mathematical equations, I said maybe there's something about energy that we spent. But I think one of the coolest thing that came from this was the realization that the way we move is potentially a reflection of the way we feel. And why do I say that? So, you know, if you see somebody walking, you can get a sense of whether, you know, are they depressed or are they happy? Mm-hmm. You know, when we say the word that, you know, when we say the phrase, they have a spring in their step, that's because they move differently. It's a reflection of both how they feel and the way they move. And that was one of the interesting observations about the way our brain controls our behavior, is that by paying attention to how somebody moves, get an understanding about their cognitive state.
It's a downstream representation of what is going on deep inside. So, something that's fascinating to me is just watching people move, just like almost like mindless movement, and it's constant. Like people just, I mean, I was sitting here doing it as you were talking about that. It's like, what is that? I've always been fascinated with that.
Yeah, I wish I understood that myself, because I know that some of us have, you know, like constant movements of our leg, or it's this restlessness. There's this energy that it needs to be spent, and I don't know much about that, why it's there, but I can tell you that coming back to the notion of understanding the cognitive state of an individual, you know, I love going to the airport and watching people when they meet each other outside of security, because it says a lot about how you feel about somebody, how you move toward that person. It's like this involuntary thing that we have in us, that we run toward people we love. And it's just, you know, you don't do that when somebody's standing there with your name that says, I'm going to pick you up in my Uber. But you will run toward the person you love, because there's this involuntary relationship between how you value that person and how you move toward them.
Yeah. That's a good description. Can you give me an explanation about, like, an overview of the cerebellum specifically?
Yeah. So let me start by going back about a century to World War One. And I'm going to share my screen with you, so we can look at one or two slides that are, you know, worthwhile in terms of giving us a little background. Okay, so let me show you this picture here. So this is a picture of a couple of soldiers during World War One. This is a German soldier. This is a British soldier. And when you look at their helmets, you notice something fundamentally different, right? So the back of the German head's soldier, you have this cover, whereas in the British soldier, you don't. And what this meant is that during World War One, the British soldiers suffered from certain kinds of damage from shrapnel or other things that affected the back of the head. And that's where the cerebellum is. And Gordon Holmes was he was a British neurologist that was stationed in France. And he examined these patients, and he noticed that, you know, these soldiers, when they had damage to the cerebellum, there was a specific part of their movement that was affected, which was near the end of their movement. So they could make the movement well to start with, but then they couldn't end it well at the end, as the for example, the arm came to the target. And he called this dysmetria, which means that the metric of the movement is something wrong with it. So the basic idea about what the cerebellum did came from these observations in patients that had damaged their cerebellum, and it said that it looked like it was important for control of movements, particularly the end of the movement. And this went along with certain other aspects of cerebellar function. I'll just describe some of the other ones. So it's not just the movement itself, but it probably also has something to do with sensory processing. And this came with experiments that looked at a simple animal called an electric fish. Electric fish is this interesting animal that puts out a motor discharge, an electric field, to sense the world around. So an electric fish lives in a muddy water. And for it to detect prey around it, what it does is that it puts out this electric field and then measures the electric field around itself and the distortions in it. It picks out, says, well, there must be something there. I'm going to pay attention to it. Maybe it's something that I can eat. So what was discovered is that there's a structure in this electric fish was called a cerebellar-like structure. And what that structure did is that it said, you just generated an electric field. That's going to overwhelm your sensors. I'm going to cancel the expected sensory consequences of this field so that I can detect the small item that exists out there in this field. And that's the second idea about this. It's called forward models, which means that the cerebellum is attempting to predict something about the sensory world around us. And when under normal conditions, probably this sensory prediction allows us to cancel out a lot of things that would have been easily predicted because of you know, the actions that we perform. So in this case, if it's an electric fish, if it generated this electric field, its sensors don't want to pick out its own field. They want to pick out the difference between what the field produced and the distortion caused by this prey. And so that's the notion of forward models, having something to do with predicting sensory things. That's one of the functions of the cerebellum. The third function has to do with learning. And the idea behind learning is that there is a relationship between a teacher and a student. The teacher is this input that comes from the cerebellum. It's called the climbing fiber. It comes from a region of the brainstem called the inferior olive. The students are the Purkinje cells, which are these principal cells in the cerebellum that basically provide the output from the cerebellar cortex. So these were the three main ideas that describe the function of the cerebellum. One is it has something to do with control of movements, particularly the endpoint of the movement. Second, it has something to do with predicting sensory events, consequences of things that you should be able to predict. And third thing is that it's a place where learning takes place. And that learning has a teacher, in this case, the inferior olive, that provides climbing fibers, and students, which are the Purkinje cells. Yeah, okay, so I'll go ahead and I'll stop there and see what you think.
Where is the inferior olive?
Right.
Part of the brainstem.
Yeah, it's part of the brain. It's in the medulla. And so it's actually like behind the, if you could get, it's one of those places that's incredibly hard to reach because it's almost behind the throat in the brainstem. So it's really hard to record from it. It's really hard to do anything about it. But it is, I think of the inferior olive as the god of the cerebellum. It tells the cerebellum how to organize itself.
Okay. So that's fascinating because they're both subdivided from the rhombencephalon. So that makes the cerebellar and the pons and the medulla. Are there sensory, motor, and interneurons going into the cerebellum? And does the cerebellum have each of those three types of neurons?
So no. So there are no motor neurons in that sense in the cerebellum. The cerebellum, by far, most of the newer part of the cerebellum is far away from motor neurons. It projects onto things that eventually reach the motor neurons, but itself is still rather many synapses away. However, there are these large inputs to the cerebellum, which are called Mossi fibers. Basically, whatever the brain is doing, whatever the rest of the brain is doing, a copy of it is sent to the cerebellum. The cerebellum computes something based on that information and sends it back to whatever region was performing that computation.
Huh. Can you explain a little bit about how it's sensory predicting? Especially, I know you use the example of the fish, but humans and the monkeys that you study obviously use something different besides that. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. Okay. So the gating of sensory information. I know that this is of particular interest because, you know, people with autistic on the spectrum, they report having abnormally sensitive or less than normal sensitivity to sensory feedback. And we can talk about the relationship between the cerebellum and autism, but I can tell you that there is a relationship between cerebellum and control of sensory input. So let's call this the gating of sensory information. So as I mentioned, the work in the electric fish, the scientist who did the work was called Curtis Bell. Curtis Bell demonstrated that that the electric fish could survive only because it has this structure that could predict and cancel the sensory feedback that it would get. Otherwise, it would just be overwhelmed by its own sensory, by its own field that it would generate. Then my colleague, Kathy Cullen, here at Johns Hopkins, studied the vestibular system. So that's the system that, you know, you use to move your head. That head causes motion, that your eyes respond to it. And So what they showed is that during voluntary head rotations, when you move your head, the Purkinje cells, that's the principal cells of the cerebellar cortex, seem to predict and then cancel the vestibular input that's coming to the cerebellum, that's and also the proprioceptive input. So from the neck muscles and the vestibular organs in your head, the Purkinje cells in that case seem to basically remove the component of the sensory feedback that's due to the motion of the animal's own head. So when the animal themselves moves their head, they cancel this sensory feedback. Perhaps it has something to do like what Curtis Bell had seen in the electric fish.
Okay, so that kind of makes sense with autistic phenotype, I think. Because maybe they're not canceling, because they're not moving their head to bias themselves to the environment. Because in large part, our eyes are doing that. Are there any inputs or communication with the superior or inferior colliculus?
Yeah. So superior colliculus, let me tell you about that. So superior colliculus, as you know, you guys have described it and you guys have had a podcast about it. It's an area that's important, particularly in mammals, in primates especially, for moving the eyes. So making saccades. And the superior colliculus has a map of space, and it basically, you know, the fact that when the fact that I can move my eyes from word to word is because of this input that comes from the colliculus, that comes to the colliculus from the retina, from the basal ganglia, from the cortex, cerebral cortex, that describe what I think of it as like a value function. Where is important stuff on this visual field? Where should I move my eyes? Okay, so then you know, you are able to control your gaze. The basal ganglia is inhibiting it, it's saying, don't look over there. I'm going to release the inhibition so you can look over there. The frontal eye field, the cerebral cortex, lateral interparietal areas provide information, excitatory information, saying that, oh, there is something useful over there, move your eyes over there. So the balance of inhibition and excitation moves your attention to some part of the visual space. The colliculus in that part generates neural activity. You generate a saccade. The eye moves to that location. You look over there. You don't need the cerebellum for this. However, as that movement is generated, the cerebellum gets a copy, and during that movement, it adds information. And that information that's added makes it so that the saccade ends on the target. Without a functioning cerebellum, the patient will show dysmetria in their eye movements, overshoot or undershoot the target, having to repeatedly correct for it.
Oh, wow. Can you show the video?
Yeah.
Sorry. And while you're pulling that up, are there any excitation inhibition, like glutamate GABA, running through the cerebellar?
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you about that as well. So let me share my screen, and let me show you a couple of examples of patients and their deficit. So here's a reaching deficit.
You can see all this color.
Okay, so that's a reaching deficit. Here's a saccade deficit. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, we study the cerebellum, and here's a MRI of the cerebellum of the monkeys that we study. These are called marmosets. And marmosets are these beautiful monkeys that live in the Brazilian jungle in the Amazon. They're a wonderful model to study because, first, they are highly social animals. They live in families of 10 or 20 marmosets. They are... they have an alpha female, so they're, as far as I know, they're one of the few primates that are ruled by females. And they are really smart. They vocalize, they recent reports suggest that they not only communicate, but they through vocalization, but they even potentially name each other. So they have this high cognitive ability to recognize each other, use sounds that are specific to a given marmoset, and they have this fabulous cerebellum, as you can see here, just this amazing structure that dominates the brain. So here's the brainstem here, and if we look at the cerebellum, you get a sense of its organization. You can see the folding. So you can see how here's this group of neurons that live in a sheet, and that sheet has been folded over and over, you know, to fit a small volume on the back of the head. And if you look closer, you see that there's this three layers in this structure. This top layer is called the molecular layer. That's where you have the inner neurons that are all inhibitory. They all rely on GABA to interact with the Purkinje layer. So the Purkinje cell is this line here that you can see. This line has a single sheet of Purkinje cells, and the Purkinje cells are these large principal neurons of the cerebellum. And then below it, this white layer are where the what's called the granule layer. You have these tiny neurons called granule cells, and it makes it so that there are more neurons here than all of the rest of the brain combined. So more than something like 70% of all the neurons in your brain are here in the cerebellum. And the reason for we having so many neurons is here because this in this white region here, the granule layer, you just have an incredibly dense collection of what's called granule cells. And their job is to convey information that they get from the rest of the brain via what's called MOSI fibers to the molecular layer and then eventually the Purkinje layer of the cerebellum.
The Purkinje cells. In autistics, the data show that there's a loss of, there's not as many Purkinje cells. And this is starting to make sense to me now.
Yeah, so why is that? And it's not just in autism. I think many cerebellar diseases, the sacrificial lamb is the Purkinje cell. Why? And I can tell you that in my experience, Purkinje cells, they sort of live at the edge of a cliff. They are these large cells that they're active all the time. They're producing spikes when you're sleeping, when you're awake, when you're taking a nap, when you're moving, when you're not moving. They're just always are producing spikes. They increase their activity or decrease their activity when you're doing something, but otherwise they're just producing 50 spikes a second or so. And so it's really incredible to have neurons in the brain that are producing all these spikes even when you're not doing anything. And it's really interesting to ask, why are we spending all this energy? What's the purpose of this? And I don't know the answer, but it's one of the puzzles. Nevertheless, damage to the cerebellum often involves the Purkinje cells, which are the output neurons of the cerebellar cortex. So without those neurons, whatever computation is taking place in the cerebellum, it is defective. It is not able to produce what it would otherwise do if the majority of the Purkinje cells were there.
I think two questions that came to mind is, Purkinje cells are only in the cerebellar, correct? And the amount of GABA that I'm learning about now is, because with autism, there's an imbalance. Too much excitation, I think, or too few GABA. So that might have some problems with this computational model.
And movements. So Ryan, the excitation inhibition balance is a common, when there's something wrong with that, there's disorders, whether it be cognitive disorders or things that are you know, associated with autism, that it's really important for a neuron, it appears now, it is really important for it to get as much excitation as inhibition on average. So you can't just have one kind. That tends to make the neuron die. And this EI balance, as it's called, seems to be critical for survival of neurons. And I want to describe to you this, the anatomy a little bit. So I said that the cerebellum receives a copy of everything that else is going on in your brain. It comes to it via these MOSSI fibers. And then it analyzes that and sends something back out specific to the region that is performing that computation. And the main puzzle is to try to understand, well, how does it do it? And what is it? You know, what is it that is adding to that? Because, you know, look, the eventual goal is to build a machine that when something has died, let's say your Purkinje cells have died. Well, we can't bring back the Purkinje cells. But what we can do is to record what is the input that's coming. What's the normal output that should have been produced? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the research is about, right? Understand how it works in a healthy cerebellum, and then build a machine that eventually will try to do something like that when there is damage.
Is this why, whenever I see like your research and things, there's learning and memory? Can you say a little bit about the memory part?
Right. So, as I mentioned, we think we understand the role of who's the teacher and who's the student. So we've learned that the inferior olive provides the information that is the teacher, and the Purkinje cells are the principal cells that are the students. And the learning is via this input. The memory is partly the synapses that form from what's called the parallel fibers, from those granule cells, those incredibly prolific and large number of cells in the cerebellum. So the parallel fibers that come from granule cells make synapses on the Purkinje cells. And it looks like the teacher, the inferior olive, when you make movements, potentially any actions that you make, any guess that you have about something, when there's an error in it, that error is sent back to the Purkinje cells. It causes plasticity in the synapses between the parallel fibers and the Purkinje cells, and that becomes the memory that is you rely on to perform the task better the next time.
Okay, this is making sense too, because if you think about a little autistic child or any child, they're going through this process in learning something, and maybe they catch it, they catch on. And then they can build repetitions and really store that ability. Or maybe they don't. So like with those eye tracking videos that you showed, or the hand movement, can you say a little bit about how the living organism learns to correct that, the error correction?
Yeah. So this is one of the main problems with treating cerebellar disease. Look, if you have a stroke, rehab helps. Because why? Rehabilitation is a process by which one is trying to teach the remaining parts of the brain how to do the task. But in cerebellar disease, the thing that's going to learn itself has been damaged. And so one of the really hard things about cerebellar disease is that there not only are no effective, really pharmaceutical ways to affect cerebellar disease. There, even rehab is difficult to use because the students, which are the Purkinje cells, if they have been damaged, well, who's going to learn? And some of the new research, what one is trying to do is to try to figure out how does one get the rest of the brain that's healthy, like the basal ganglia? How does one get that part of the brain to try to compensate for, you know, the part that has been damaged?
Okay. Kind of rescue, or the basal ganglia will maybe act as supplementing that damage.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the rules of learning for basal ganglia are different than the cerebellum. And so some of the ideas are to make the errors in such a way, it's called reinforcement learning, that engages the remaining neural structures and tries to take out the part that isn't working, the cerebellum, and try to focus the learning on the part that is working, in this case, the basal ganglia.
And this is a little bit different role for the basal ganglia, or is it something that's normal?
No, this is normal. So, okay. But for some reason, that normal function isn't good enough to help recover some of the functions that are lost from the cerebellum. And the idea is, and this is theory with just a few experiments that have gone after it, and this is Amanda Theron's work and my colleague Amy Bastian have worked in this area to try to say, can we skew the error so that it becomes more the morsel of food for the basal ganglia rather than for the cerebellum, so that you rely on the structures that are working well to try to compensate. This is what rehab is trying to do.
Huh. Is there any consideration that there are many more nuclei going on within the basal ganglia with those five cortical or subcortical regions? Or is that not right? Is the cerebellum that complex as well?
Oh, yeah. The in some ways, the basal ganglia, I mean, complexity is interesting the way you say it. In some ways, they're similar. So both basal ganglia and the cerebellum have neurons that largely rely on GABA, inhibitory neurons. And both of the structures have neurons that tend to be active no matter what. They're spending their energy. But they seem to compute different kinds of things, I would say. I mean, we talked a little bit about how you direct your gaze to areas that you find rewarding. So you look at, so you know, when you open a web page, if there's a picture of a face, you're more than likely going to look at it rather than, you know, something else, a mountain or something. And that probably has something to do with this value function that your basal ganglia and maybe the frontal eye field impose on you, that faces are special, they're particularly rewarding, you know, you should look at it. Probably has something to do with the basal ganglia. The cerebellum is more important in helping you make that movement correctly, predicting what would happen when you get there. And, you know, one of the big puzzles is, because cerebellar patients, it isn't just that they have movement disorders. They also have impulse control effects. They have this thing called dysmetria of thought. So the planning seems to be something wrong with what's happening. And I think that we just happen to see the movement disorder because it's sort of like the obvious thing that a neurologist would examine. It's much harder to, you know, examine planning. But they do have these disorders as well. So the cerebellum is involved in so much of our normal behavior, far outside of just making movements.
I love the idea of we use internal calculators. I call them internal calculators. Biological calculators could work as well. But whenever you're talking about that value, is I think it reminded me of that.
So, you know, I can show you an example of an internal calculator. So
yeah, I would love that. I love internal calculators.
I don't know if you can see this. Oh, I can. Let me show you a video. Let me show you a video so you don't have to look at me. So I think a video would be even better. All right. So let me share my screen again.
I love the idea of these internal calculators because our brain is a prediction machine. That's number one thing.
Exactly as you say. Okay, so here's an internal calculator. All right, so here's a simple experiment. So here's this young man. He's holding a book in his hand, and look what happens here now. Okay, so the idea is, if somebody picks the book off my hand, I can't help but my arm is going to move up. And why is that? Well, because there's delay in the sensory system. I can't react fast enough to what's happening. But if me myself goes to pick up that book, my hand stays perfectly flat. This is because I'm able to predict precisely when this is going to happen. And I know by how much I should turn off the muscles, in this case, the biceps, so the arm doesn't just, you know, lift up as the book is moved up. Okay, so you see, this is that's the basic idea of this internal calculator that is working all the time, and we don't even think about it, right?
Yeah, and we have many of them. So the reason why the hand moves up, though, is because there's no way to predict accurately how fast and how much effort the other person is going to need and the time to remove that.
Yeah, exactly. So I make the joke to my students that if there's one lesson that I have is that when you go to a fancy party and, you know, the waiter comes with the drinks, you let the waiter pick up the glass and give it to you.
Yeah, because there's accidents. That's so fascinating. We have so many internal calculators. It's just constantly going.
Yeah, you know, and these internal calculators are underneath our consciousness. And when they stop working, they really become a difficult thing to live with, right? Because they really change the way we are, because we now have to pay attention to so much that we didn't used to have to pay attention to.
Yeah, okay. One of the more significant internal calculators, I think, comes from the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, which sends a signal down to the dorsal striatum. And I think that helps orchestrate motor movements and activity of the living organism, like, quite well. And that reminds me, I want to ask, because that's more of a goal-directed type of movement. And I know you've done research on goal-directed. Are the inputs and the signals going through the cerebellum for a goal-directed activity different than a habit?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Let me describe it to you in this way. So we work with monkeys, and like any animal trainer, you know, you train them to work for food. So you get them to do your task, and then you give them food, and that's the business ratio, you know, the component of this relationship. But they make movements otherwise as well. So it's not like they only make movements because there's food. They also make movements because they want to. And it's interesting to compare when they're making a movement for us for the purpose of getting food versus when they're making just movement because they're interested in, you know, exploring their environment. Mm-hmm. And what you see is that the cerebellum is much more involved when the movement is made because there is something rewarding, something, you know, there's a purpose for in this case, to get food. It's similar movement when they make, and it's just because they do it because they want to explore their environment. The things that we see in the cerebellum are not the same. They're much less involved in control of that movement. So it's as if you need to make something, do something well, you engage the cerebellum much more than just any movement that doesn't matter that much.
That probably has some evolutionary considerations there about movement for reward and how we've worked so hard to sustain our species, and our we seek out and we navigate for like those primitive aspects like food, shelter, water, security, mating, all of these underlying reward things that humans and other species have kind of built this reward pathway from. Now, today, we have a lot more access to so-called rewards. And a bad part about that is, as we were talking about, the rewards have more value if you put effort in first, effort then reward. And that's how these circuits were made. But now we don't have to do the effort for the reward. It's like with the technology and all of these other things that are just probably not well for us. But
yeah. So the relationship between reward and effort is really fascinating. I, as I mentioned to you, you can think about certain movements. I mean, you can think about a frog that needs to stick its tongue out in order to catch a fly. You got to get one try. And you know, it better be on target. And, you know, I think that a structure like the cerebellum is particularly well suited for those attempts that matter. Because we see that those movements that are associated with reward, where the goal means something important, where you have to be accurate, that's when the cerebellum is really active. I wanted to tell you, Ryan, about one of the most surprising things that we've learned about the cerebellum. And it goes something like this. So, you know, you think that neurons in your brain are active because you're doing something. So say that I'm moving my arm and I see these neurons active. And I think that, these neurons must have something to do with moving the arm. Mm-hmm. That seems natural. And this has been like the basic foundation of so much of neuroscience, to relate how neurons relate to behavior. But one of the things we found in the cerebellum that was really surprising is that, first of all, the neurons are active, not just all the time, but doesn't matter whether you move your arm up, down, left, right. You know, as long as you're moving your arm, these neurons are active. So that was really puzzling. And then what we found was that much of this activity wasn't because to move the limb in the way you were moving it, but to cancel the activity that other neurons were producing that would otherwise harm the movement that you were making. So it's as if you have a population that's active, half of them are active to cancel the effects of each other so that they don't inject noise in the behavior that you're trying to produce. So if that's true, even if that theory is right, that says that, you know, when damage occurs and some of these cells die, part of the deficit is because the parts that are active and should in fact be suppressed are not being suppressed, because the ones that would have suppressed them aren't there.
So hand-eye coordination, hand-eye coordination, I'm in. It seems like this is involved, and precise fine motor movements. I can't get my head around how much the cerebellum is involved here, and then things like the substantia nigra and the red nucleus.
Let me describe the relationship. Okay, substantia nigra has two parts, the reticulata and the compacta. Compacta has the dopamine cells. The reticulata is the output structure in the substantia. These are basal ganglia structures. So I can tell you about both of these. So substantia nigra reticulata is an output structure of the basal ganglia. And let's say we want to make an eye movement. It projects onto the superior colliculus. It inhibits the superior colliculus. Basically, it says don't move. And when it releases this inhibition, then you are biased toward moving toward certain region. And that release of inhibition coincides with excitatory input that comes from the cerebral cortex. Release of inhibition coupled with excitation makes it so that you decide to make this movement. You have to release inhibition and you have to produce excitation so that now you make a movement. So you can now see that the basal ganglia would have something to do with reward, because it describes how you would make movements toward things that you value. You would move toward things that you value and not care about the ones that you don't. The relationship between this and the cerebellum is that the basal ganglia has this value information. And if you now look at the cerebellum, you find that that value information makes the cerebellum work better. Meaning that, remember that cancellation I was telling you about. So the cerebellum is made aware of the value of this action that you're about to make. And that coordination of the neurons in the cerebellum to produce the output that they do is much better balanced, so that it produces an output associated with just the action you're making and cancel the things that would have diverted that action away from it. So that's relating reward, substantia nigra reticulata of the basal ganglia, and control of movements in cerebellum. Okay, now there's dopamine. Dopamine comes from SNC, substantia nigra compacta. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that affects so much of our behavior. And it turns out that an output from the cerebellum projects directly to SNC dopamine neurons. So the cerebellum is providing an input that's relevant to control of dopamine in SNC. This was a new discovery. Cameron Khodakha, he's a professor at Albert Einstein University in New York. He discovered this pathway and demonstrated that it's important for control of behavior in mice.
Okay, so cerebellar to the compacta, compacta probably up to the dorsal striatum, and then it's orchestrating next movements, subsequent movements.
Yeah, I really think that, if there is a structure in the brain that's doing something important, the cerebellum more than likely is contributing to it.
Okay. Recently, and the reason why I contacted you was the Purkinje cells with the tongue movements. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure, sure. So, control of speech and vocalization is so hard to study because the tongue is inside a mouth, that you can't measure it so easily, right? How do you do that? But yet, if you see a cerebellar patient, one of the first things you notice is that it's hard for them to talk. They sound like as if they have marbles in their mouth. It's really hard to move the tongue properly, and it's really been hard to study the control of the tongue. How does that happen? And so marmosets are like next to giraffes. They are the tongue animals, in my opinion. They have a fabulous tongue. They have this long tongue that they use in the wild to insert inside the tree little holes and get sap out. And they're really dexterous with their tongue, and they control it in this beautiful way. And as I mentioned to you, they're also very vocal animals, so they can make sounds and they use it for communication between them. So, okay, they make a good model to study control of the tongue. All right, so we wanted to know, all right, how do they do it, and what does the cerebellum have to do with it? So we set up this task that made the marmosets use their tongue to go laterally to food tubes that were sitting 90 degrees with their mouth. So they had to stretch their tongue out, put it inside the tubes to get this slurry of food out. And okay, so they learned to do it, and it was no problem. It was like, okay, we know how to do this. The animals were so good at it. And while they were doing that, we were trying to understand what is the cerebellum is doing to control these movements. And what we found was that those Purkinje cells, they had a lot to do with stopping the tongue at the right place when the tongue went out, so that it wouldn't miss the tube, so that it would stop where the tube was located. So just like what we had seen with control of the eye, we saw that for control of the tongue, there was something similar taking place in learning to predict, when you're about to reach your target, stop the movement now.
That's cool. That's a fascinating finding. The deceleration of tongue movements.
Yeah, the deceleration of the movement and stopping it on target. And, but this is related to sensory feedback. Let me tell you why. Because, the movement is taking place quickly. The sensory feedback is slow. Basically, our sensors are slow things. They detect things and transmit their information more or less at the speed of sound. So much of our accuracy depends on not the feedback that we get, but predicting what the feedback should be. And the cerebellum seems to have a lot to do with that, predicting it and helping you generate commands that, make your movements accurate.
Makes sense. Yeah, this is also good. Is there anything else about the cerebellum that you find important that I haven't asked you about?
Yeah, you asked such wonderful questions. I'm so grateful that we had a chance to talk. I think that there just isn't that much interest in the cerebellum because I think that it's like a hard puzzle to figure out, and that the mechanisms of how it functions and so forth, we haven't made that much progress. But yet, you know, there are people that have suffered from cerebellar disease, and maybe it has a lot to do with autism as well, because as you know, anatomical studies show that people, when they die, they've had autism during their life, the cerebellum is probably the most important structure that looks different than normal. It has a reduced size, and the Purkinje cells die, but it's like this whole other brain. And it has its own language. And, you know, being a neuroscientist is like getting signals from a foreign, you know, from a different planet. And you're trying to understand, what are they trying to tell me? Mm. You know, I'm trying to decipher this language that I don't understand. Mm. And so much of our work and the people in my community is about trying to understand the language of the cerebellum, which is different than the language of the cerebral cortex. And and I hope that we get better at decoding, you know, what is the cerebellum trying to tell us? And once we understand it, you know, building therapies and machines that can replace the things that have been lost.
Yeah, that's well said. Because the cerebellum is definitely underrated. It's super valuable. But last question. What is something recently that you're most excited about?
Yeah, you know, I think that down the road, the goal is to build a machine that when there is damage to the cerebellum, it can do something about it. You know, that you can implant a chip that would say, I'm going to listen to the inputs that are coming, and I'm going to tell you what the output should be, even though you don't have the Purkinje cells to produce it. And I mean, that's the billion-dollar dream of not just understand how something works, but replace it with some devices that will, repair the transformations that would have taken place and provide the signals that would have been there if the thing was working well. And I genuinely think that, you know, perhaps not in my lifetime, but in my students' lifetime, in your lifetime, Brian, these things are coming. As we better understand how the system works, we'll be able to someday build these circuits that that can, you know, be implanted and make it so that the damaged system can be partially repaired.
Yeah, and your work's going to provide the instruction manual.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I can't thank you enough. This is one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever had in my life.
You're very, very kind of you, Ryan. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you for joining.